Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. When we're looking for the kind of intelligence that really makes a difference in that war for the free world, we usually start with my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, our Senior Vice President for Policy and Programs, Fred Flights. He is, after all, a career intelligence professional with some 20 years of service at the Central Intelligence Agency, time as the Chief of Staff to Ambassador John Bolton in the State Department, and as a professional staff member of the House Intelligence Committee under then-Chairman Pete Hoekstra. Fred Flights is, of course, the author of a terrifically important book, Obama Bomb, The Great and Growing National Security Fraud. He is an active contributor to our public policy debate on so many different platforms and channels, and it's always a delight to have him on ours. Fred, welcome back.
Hey, Frank. Good to be here.
So, Fred, I want to start with a country that you've been tracking very closely, both in the intelligence community as well as currently with us, and that is North Korea. Of course, it has been improving inexorably its capacity to attack the United States, something it has for decades claimed it wanted to do, to destroy us. Has the moment arrived, in your professional judgment, Fred Flights, that they're able to do that?
Well, I don't know whether North Korea can strike the United States right now with a nuclear-tipped missile. My guess is they are not quite there, but they made a major advance on the 28th of November when they tested a Hwasong-15 ICBM, which was fired 2,800 miles into space. That would give it a range of about 8,000 miles fired on a normal trajectory, putting Washington, D.C. and the entire United States within its range. Now, there's some questions about its accuracy, but it had a lot of advanced features, a very large nose cone, a very advanced steering system. It is a major, major threat, a major technological development.
The question occurs, of course, Fred, the speed with which these missiles are being rolled out and fired, and the improvements, as you say, in some of them, suggests that an impoverished, backwards country is unlikely to be doing all of this by itself. Where do you think the help that is making the threat that is, if it's not here today, it is imminent to this country possible in North Korea at the moment?
There was a huge surge in its nuclear missile technology, especially in 2016. I think there are credible reports that North Korea is getting at least missile and probably nuclear assistance from China. And there are some very credible reports that advanced rocket designs have been reaching North Korea, either from Ukraine or from Russia, or they may be Russian agents stealing them from missile factories in Ukraine. This has to be part of the discussion here, not just sanctions on North Korea, but how Russia and China are assisting North Korea's WMD programs.
Yeah, but it really seems to me, frankly, that we ought to be clearly holding the Chinese especially to account here. We have evidence, as you know, Fred Flights, of so-called transporter erector launchers being supplied by the Chinese to the North Koreans. Some accounts suggest that the missile canisters that go on those so-called TELs are also Chinese made, and what goes in those canisters now being fired by the North Koreans may as well be from China. In fact, I would argue that the threat from North Korea today is made in China. If that is the case, Fred, is the Trump administration doing all that it needs to hold China accountable for enabling this threat to continue to metastasize?
Well, I haven't heard this issue raised in our pressure on China, but I think it's a complex situation because there's certainly evidence that China is aiding the missile program. On the other hand, the Chinese have become worried about the progress of the nuclear program because of the possibility of radiation leaking into China from a nuclear test that has a containment failure. So I think we have to really press China, you know, not only to hold them accountable, but to make the case that accidents in missile and nuclear tests will affect China and that they're just hurting themselves.
Well, I, for one, am at the point now where I think we've got to be going to the Chinese in these private conversations that the president had yesterday with Xi Jinping and saying, look, you've got to get rid of this guy. I think this is likely we'll get another Chinese proxy, but I think this dynasty is demonstrably dangerous, and it is going to be a problem for them if they don't take action here. Fred, one of the things that is breaking as we're speaking is a report out of originally, I believe, the New York Times, that the U.S. Secretary of State, who has been spending a fair amount of time on this North Korea portfolio without appreciable results, as best I can tell, is about to resign from office sometime in the next couple of weeks, evidently. Is that a surprise for one? And what will be his legacy as you see it? And who do you think will likely replace it?
Well, it's not a surprise. I don't think Secretary Tillerson ever figured out a way on how to be a Secretary of State or had a good relationship with the president. And I'm very concerned. He has a massive reform plan of the State Department that still isn't implemented. And I think he's wasted a whole year with process and bureaucracy rather than implementing the president's policies and staffing the State Department. I have heard that CIA Director Mike Pompeo is a leading candidate to become the new Secretary of State. If that's the case, I think he'd be an excellent choice.
I do, too. As to this plan, there's been considerable bellyaching about it from within the Foreign Service ranks, particularly. Numbers of people have been said to be bailing out of the State Department out of frustration. More generally, there's a sense that there is not competent hands on deck at the moment, either in the political appointees or from the career and foreign service sides. You spent time, as I mentioned, working for John Bolton on the senior decks of the State Department, Fred Flights. Do you credit those reports? And if so, what should Trump be doing with a new secretary when he is installed?
Well, I think it's true morale is low, and I think that reflects the fact that there's been poor management under Tillerson. On the other hand, bureaucracies hate streamlining and reorganizations, and I don't believe these reports of massive numbers of state officers leaving. I just don't think it's true. I think there's natural attrition when administrations change, people are reassigned or let go. I think if we went through all that, we find that's what's really going on here. I think we need a new Secretary of State who will basically address the morale problems, staff the building, and just try to find a way to the highest extent possible to find a way to get the state careerists on board and to promote the president's agenda. I think with a good leader and with a good leadership team, that can be accomplished.
Yeah, from your lips to God's ears, I'm not sure. There does seem to be a lot of resistance to the president's agenda, particularly among the professional staff there. Fred, let me turn quickly to a piece that you recently wrote for Newsmax about the importance of what President Trump is trying to do to improve relations with Russia at a time that's clearly fraught, given all of the charges about his collusion and the provable, demonstrable collusion of the previous administration, and particularly Hillary Clinton, with the Russians. Talk a little bit about your thinking on that subject.
You know, the Obama administration thought they could push Russia around and make it do what we wanted with ultimatums and threats and sanctions. That's not going to work with a nation like this, a nuclear-armed nation like Russia. We have to find a modus vivendi, a way of working with Russia. Russia respects strength. It respects American leadership. And I think by restoring American leadership and trying to find areas on which we can cooperate, we still have to hold them accountable. But some of these sanctions we're placing on Russia, a future president is just going to lift them. They're never going to work. We have to find areas of mutual cooperation, focus on the problem areas, and negotiate with them, and not simply do what John Kerry did. I think every other week he issued an ultimatum. That's why the Russians are negotiating their own solution to Syria with Turkey and Iran, and we're not involved. That began under President Obama. This has to be reversed.
This is a subject we're going to turn to momentarily with Dr. Herbert London of the London Center for Policy Research. Fred Flights, we have to leave it at that with you, though. Thank you very much for kicking us off today, as well as for the great work you do at the Center for Security Policy, as well as your service to our country in your previous capacities. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us next week. Next up, we will speak with Matt Continetti of the Washington Free Beacon about the call of freedom and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Matt Continetti. He is the editor-in-chief these days of a superb online resource. It is the Washington Free Beacon. Prior to joining the Beacon, he was an opinion editor at the Weekly Standard, and he is the author of numerous important books, including notably The K Street Gang, The Rise and Fall of the Republican Machine, and The Persecution of Sarah Palin: How the Elite Media Tried to Bring Down a Rising Star. Matt Continetti, it's great to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
You know, I've always found your essays at the Free Beacon to be interesting, but I've got a trifecta of sorts that I wanted to walk through with you in the brief time we have with you, Matt, starting with a retrospective you did recently on the, well, pretty close to the first year of the Trump administration and where you think things are at the end of that period and where he goes from here.
Well, depending on the outcome of this tax vote in the Senate, I think President Trump will have a pretty successful year in office. And so, yeah, I dated it Trump year one from his election. So that's why my take on the first year is a little bit advanced. So a lot depends, I think, on the tax vote. If he does get the tax vote, then he's basically one for two in terms of his big legislative aims. But I'll say that, you know, the tax vote as of now includes the repeal of the Obamacare individual mandate. And that, of course, is hated by Americans, including many conservatives. I think that'd be a victory, a healthcare victory embedded within the tax bill. So I also expect them to return to Obamacare sometime next year and try again and repeal it. So combine those, you know, question or up in the air achievements with his record on the judiciary and his record in deregulation, and then the business-friendly climate, which has led to this incredible surge in the stock market and consumer confidence. I think on balance, he's had a pretty good year in terms of his administration.
Yeah, some of it, to be sure, is an incomplete, but there are some signs that it may wind up promising. Let me ask you in that regard, though, about, of course, the particular portfolio of this program, namely the national security and foreign policy briefs. We are being told, as I was speaking about a moment ago with Fred Flights, that the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, is to be out the door shortly. His tenure has been, shall we say, checkered at best. Where do you put the grade with respect to the president's conduct of foreign policy and some of the challenges he's faced, not least internally, to it?
You know, a big part of President Trump's job is kind of reestablishing the America's deterrent. And I think he got off to a good start at the beginning of the year in retaliating against Bashar Assad for chemical weapons use, dropping the Moab bomb in Afghanistan. Kind of, he's building up our armed forces. He's clearly supportive of the troops. He's also said we weren't going to retreat from Afghanistan, which I think was I personally think was an important decision of his. In terms of the end game of ISIS, we've rolled back ISIS. On the other hand, though, I'm not sure how well the administration has been planning for the kind of the conflict after the conflict, the day after. And I feel like we're ceding ground to Iran and to Russia in the Middle East. And I'm very worried about that. So in North Korea, he's certainly talked tough, but I think he's relying too much on his personal relationship with Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader. And that has not produced results in terms of kind of a lowering of tensions because, of course, North Korea just testing a new ICBM in recent days. So I'd say the foreign policy record is much more incomplete than the domestic policy one. And while he does have some successes in foreign policy, especially on the ISIS campaign and kind of relaxing some of the rules of engagement there, I do worry about what comes next.
I do as well. And Matt Continetti, I would just go back to what you said at the beginning of that answer. A lot is going to ride on whether he actually does restore America's deterrent. And that is a very incomplete a task at the moment, most especially. In fact, I had a fascinating hour-long conversation on this program with Dakota Wood of the Heritage Foundation recently, in which he walked through the index of U.S. military strength that the Heritage Foundation has just published. And it is a shattering portrayal of a seriously degraded, if not actually broken, military. So there's a lot to be done in that department. And as you know so well, as a student of history, it will inform a lot of other things that the president is trying to do, certainly internationally. Matt, you talked interestingly enough in another of your pieces about a great American earthquake, suggesting that the Republic itself is actually being rocked at the moment. Square that, if you would, with what you've just said about the president's performance to date and the contribution he's making, perhaps, to the tremors you're talking about.
And, you know, I think President Trump is one of the consequences of this tremor that's happening in our society. The idea that America would reach the point where we would turn to a total outsider from politics, someone who had no experience in governance. He had no military experience other than attending a military academy in his high school years. This is very unusual for Americans to elect someone like this. In fact, it's never been done before. He's also probably the richest man ever elected president. So I think that in itself was a sign that something deep is changing in America. And so what I wrote about in the essay you mentioned, Frank, was, well, where is that coming from? And I feel it's coming from several sources, or technology, a decline of the family, kind of the waning of the religious sensibility. A big part of it is just simply a lack of self-control among individuals. And we see that, of course, reflected in this wave of sexual harassment accusations. And just for me, someone, a civilian in all of this, I'm watching the news and just, why parents never taught these people to exercise self-control? I just don't understand it. But I think that itself is a cause of a lot of our tremors today.
That's a very important insight. It is symptomatic, I think, of a lack of both morality on the one hand and a sense that there are things more important than you in the world, you know, and your pleasures and imminent needs and the like. Matt, finally, let me ask you about a third and very important essay that you recently filed, the Washington Free Beacon, The Call of Freedom, you entitled it, and you were inspired to do so, I think, by this recent incident at the demilitarized zone in North Korea. Just walk us through that very quickly, if you would, as well.
Oh, this amazing story that happened Thanksgiving week with a North Korean staff sergeant. He's known only by his surname, O. Basically escaped North Korea. And in the middle of traversing the line of control, was shot 5 times by his former compatriots in the North Korean armed forces. And he survived. And for me, you know, it just struck me that the people who flee communism are always fleeing in one direction. They're always fleeing toward freedom. You never get the sense of people escaping to communist or socialist states. That doesn't happen. And so for me, this kind of reiterated, and I think a time that we need it, that of just the idea that freedom is precious, and it's important, and it's part of the American experience. It's what makes this country special and also makes it exceptional. And I think I see on the left and even in some corners of the right now, people kind of dismissing or denigrating the idea of freedom.
Not just taking it for granted, but actually deriding it.
Exactly. And I think they're missing something there. And I think they make category error. They take the problems of our society and they somehow blame them to the on the concept of freedom. But I thought it was important to remember what this country is all about, and especially on Thanksgiving week.
Amen to that. And those who don't have it know how valuable it is, and we take it for granted. Thank you, Matt Continetti, for sharing these important insights with us and for the great work you do with the Washington Free Beacon. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Dr. Herbert London will join us next. We'll talk about developments in Saudi Arabia and more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is with the greatest of pleasure that I say we are joined once again by a friend and colleague of many years, an inspiration, a mentor even, I would argue, Dr. Herbert London. These days, he runs his own institute. It is called the London Center for Policy Research. He has been a denizen of myriad other think tanks over the years and has been a prolific contributor to the public policy debate, with more books than I can shake a stick at, but particularly noteworthy, the most recent one, Leading from Behind, the Obama Doctrine and Retreat from International Affairs, really a trenchant and very timely indictment of the previous administration's policies, which I think probably contributed to the election of someone who said he wanted to make a course correction. Dr. London, it is so good to have you with us, sir.
Well, Frank, always a pleasure to be with you.
Let me talk to you about two things that you have recently been musing about, one at Family Security Matters, the other at the Washington Times. The first involves what has been developing and, frankly, continues to be unfolding by the day, it seems, with respect to Saudi Arabia. You entitled the piece, The Saudi Dilemma. Tell us what the dilemma is, as you see it, Herb, and how it is sorting at the moment.
Well, since 1979, when the religious sites in Mecca were attacked, the Saudis have engaged in an extortion payment to the Wahhabi clerics across the globe. This is one of the reasons why you've seen the radicalization of so many of the madrasas on an international scale. What has happened here with the crown prince, he's 32 years old. He's making a bet on the future. It's a demographic bet. 75% of the people in Saudi Arabia are under 30 years old. He is saying, I think they are far more interested in rock and roll than they are in the rigidities of Islam. And as a consequence, I'm going to introduce modernization into Saudi Arabia. Now, needless to say, there's tremendous tension as a consequence. There are people in the large Saudi family who are very much upset. There are Wahhabi clerics who are very much upset. But he has made it clear this is the direction for the future of Saudi Arabia. In 25 years, Saudi Arabia may not have the oil necessary to sustain the present economy. As a result, diversification is probably necessary. Well, that's only going to occur if the economy and the society modernizes.
Let me ask you, there are those who say that this young crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, who may be king at any day, I guess, acted in part against some of those Saudi royals and, for that matter, some of those Wahhabi clerics, incarcerating them, at least for a time. Some of them went to the Ritz-Carlton to be detained. But he did that because he was facing, not just sort of in an abstract way, pushback, but the prospect of an actual coup against him. Is that your reading, or was this simply the kind of step that was necessary to move forward with this reform agenda? And what do you make of the fact that he apparently released the Ritz-Carlton detainees?
Well, look, I knew he was going to release them. What you have to remember is that Ibn Saud, who was the founder of Saudi Arabia, the first king, had roughly 23, 24 children. And that led to thousands of people in the royal family. You cannot maintain a royal family under those conditions. He recognized that. What he is saying to his relatives is there's only one branch of the family that counts. That's mine. And if you want to engage in investments, whether these are investments in Google or in 20th Century Fox or whatever it happens to be, it's going to be done through the auspices of my operation. And you are going to pay allegiance to me. This is the only way he could get the reforms introduced. I don't like dictatorial methods, but at the same time, I also understand Saudi Arabia is an idiosyncratic nation, very different from other places. As a consequence, if you're going to introduce modernization, there's only one way to do it. impose it on the society.
It was the communists who coined the phrase that you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs. And I guess this is the application of that, too, as you say.
Well, as again, I don't buy into the Leninist formulation. But at the same time, it's absurd to think there would be democratic reforms in a place like Saudi Arabia.
Herb, let me ask you about a thesis that was propounded on our program yesterday by Dr. Hillel Frisch of the Bar-Ilan University in Israel, that what is going on here is not just the kind of demographic, you know, course correction and policy, domestic, economic, and so on that flows from it, but that the Crown Prince is actually preparing the country for war, all-out conflict against Iran. Do you think that's a piece of the mix here as well?
Well, when that missile flew into Riyadh, and obviously it was not Houthi, the Houthis do not have the technical capability of making that happen. It was an Iranian missile. That was the Crown Prince said, this is a declaration of war. He made it perfectly clear. And there's no question, if you look at the putative leader in the Sunni world, it's Saudi Arabia. And if you look at what is happening in the Shia world, it's Iran. There will be a conflict between the two. When that conflict arises, it will be an ugly mess. But there is no doubt that the prince wants to avoid that for the time being. He is prepared to go to war, but not now. And I think that the Iranians have the upper edge when it comes to military capabilities at the moment. That is one of the reasons why the Crown Prince has worked very hard to try and create a Sunni defense condominium that would offset the advantages that Iran has at the moment.
Including pulling in Israel, of course. Herb, let me back the lens up to talk for a moment about the other piece that you wrote recently in the Washington Times about Russia's role in the Middle East, in that cauldron that you've just described. It is clearly playing an outsized role, indeed, and doing so to some extent in supplanting the United States, which speaks to your point about the Obama doctrine's retreat from international affairs. Give us a flavor of how you see the Russians playing at the moment and whether that's a force for good or ill.
Well, I mean, the Russians have allied themselves with the Iranians and Hezbollah. That cannot be a force for good. What the Russians are doing is, in some sense, nefarious. They've built a very, very sizable fleet in Tartus. They've got a rather dramatic air base in Latakia. They have Russians all over Syria, including building four nuclear plants in Syria. They have taken over Crimea. All of this has occurred with the Russians becoming the strong horse in the Eastern Mediterranean. So there is no doubt they've supplanted the United States to some degree. I think the Trump administration also handled this very poorly. And I'll tell you how. When we defeated ISIS, or at least the strongholds in ISIS in Raqqa and in Mosul, the United States at that point did not develop a policy for dealing with the Iranians and the Russians. As a consequence, the Russians have complete control over all aspects of northern Iraq and Syria. When an attack occurred in Kirkuk, you would have thought the United States would have responded. We did not. We have obviously sent a signal to the Russians. You can control this area. This is a very, very dangerous development because it means at some point Israel will have to go to war with Hezbollah. Hezbollah has assembled close to 150,000 missiles in Lebanon. That's an intolerable situation for Israel.
And it, you know, Herb, a further wild card in all of that, of course, as you know so well, is it may not be just be Hezbollah Israel's up against, but it may be Iran, their enabler, their masters, if you will, and perhaps, certainly at a minimum, Russian air defenses that will change very much the character of the kind of qualitative edge that Israel has long relied upon to project power and assure its security in that very, very tricky part of the world. Herb, we are out of time, I'm afraid. And there's so much more to talk about. I'm delighted that you've agreed in principle to come back and spend a full hour with us in the near future, because there's really so much we need to tap your extraordinary corporate memory and intellect to understand better. And I appreciate so much your time today and look forward to doing that before the holidays. In the meantime, God bless you and the great work you do at the London Center for Policy Research, and we'll talk with you very soon. Next up, Noni Darwish joins us. We'll talk about the peculiar situation of the institutionalization of misogyny by people that are not getting blamed for it. Right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It is with great pleasure that I say we are joined by a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy and an extraordinary contributor to what I think of as the war for the free world, the fight to help the rest of us understand what's at stake and to lead by example in waging it to save Western civilization. She is Noni Darwish, the director of Former Muslims United, the founder of Arabs for Israel, a frequent contributor to the superb publications of the Gatestone Institute, and the author of numerous extraordinarily important books, including Now They Call Me Infidel, Why I Renounced Jihad for America, Israel, and the War on Terror. She's also the author most recently of Wholly Different, Why I Chose Biblical Values Over Islamic Values. Noni Darwish, thank you so much for taking some time. It's great to have you. Welcome back.
My pleasure, Frank. Thank you.
I wanted to mull with you a topic that I've just been stunned isn't more in the public focus at the moment. We're hearing, of course, and with good reason, about, it seems, a nearly endless stream of media personalities, politicians, journalists, and others who are being challenged and in some cases punished for their sexual harassment of women, colleagues, others, and in some cases downright sexual abuse. And I wanted to ask you, Noni, as someone who grew up in Egypt and who has spent most of her life either living under the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia, or warning about it and helping the rest of us, as I say, understand the threat it poses. What do you make, Noni, of the fact that the practice of sexual harassment and abuse and misogyny more generally is not simply, you know, condoned by Sharia, it is considered obligatory, and that that's not getting talked about at all?
Exactly. And the problem, I mean, there was an Egyptian sheikh who recently said that it is a national obligation to sexually harass women who are not properly dressed and even rape. So it's kind of a punishment of a woman if she's out of line and her ankle is showing, or God forbid she's wearing a jeans that's torn, that she deserves to be sexually harassed and even raped. I remember my days when I was a young girl in Egypt and I would walk downtown Cairo and it was very crowded. And we, because the punishment for us for not wearing our head cover would be pinched as we walk. And I remember that, and it was very degrading, very humiliating. It's almost like I am a loose woman for not being properly covered, so I deserve to be pinched. I deserve to be sexually harassed on the street.
And if I'm not mistaken, Noni, those were back in the days when it was not that repressive in Egypt. So you can only imagine how much worse it is in those countries where it is in full thrall to Sharia. And Noni, you've been so courageous and exemplary in trying to warn about the various manifestations of this kind of misogyny towards women and girls under Sharia, including in America. And I'd like you to talk about one of the most egregious examples of it, this practice of female genital mutilation. There's a federal trial going on, as you know, in Michigan. But is that likely to be kind of the extent of it, do you think? Or is that really the tip of a much larger and quite appalling iceberg in America today?
It is the tip of the iceberg, absolutely. It is a kind of sexual oppression of women. Female genital mutilation is more than just a little operation for on a girl, a child, really, against her will, because you cannot consent a seven-year-old girl
to a permanent mutilation, no less.
Absolutely, and this is a lot bigger than just for one or two people. This is implanting in our culture an element of despising women, of wanting to put them in their place, of wanting to deprive them of their natural, God-given right to be a woman, to be a female, and telling the woman that your place is only for childbirth, and that's it. And it is creeping into our culture, and it's going to be devastating on the way we look at women.
Yeah, you've written a book about biblical values versus these Islamic values, and this is a case where they clearly are very much clashing. Noni, let me ask you about one thing that you've mentioned to me before, and I think it's important to keep this in mind when we're talking about this practice of female genital mutilation, and that is you've described the contribution that you think it makes, at least in the minds of those who promote it, not just to keeping women down, but to facilitating jihad. Connect that dot, if you would.
Absolutely. Islam, the objective of Islam is not to make people happier or, you know, love one another. The goal of Islam is to expand. That's the goal of Islam, at the expense of other religions, of other ideologies and other faiths. Expand through jihad. So the number one duty of a man in Islam is to go to war and sacrifice his life, his family, his wife, everything for jihad, for the expansion of Islam. And what's standing in the way in that objective is a man who loves his wife.
And his wife loves him and doesn't want him to possibly sacrifice himself.
And a man who loves his children and makes God, you know, family first. So in Islam, family should not come first. Jihad should come first. In that formula, in that calculation, women are the enemy. Women must be oppressed, and women must be shown their place in order for the man to never give them anything higher than jihad. A woman in Islam should never be above jihad.
And she certainly shouldn't have an attachment to her man that might, again, keep him from serving in that role. And Noni, very quickly, let me turn to one other piece of this, the sort of Sharia supremacism and jihad against the West. There's this controversy raging at the moment, as you know, about President Trump retweeting several videos that show, to varying degrees, it seems, if not actually the practice of some of these jihadis in Western societies, exemplary behavior that one has associated with them. What do you make of this, Noni? Is the president right to be, if not specifically pulling up these particular videos from this particular post, but making the general point we're at war with Sharia supremacism?
Absolutely. I mean, they should be happy that a president is courageous enough to point at what everybody is scared of, which is radical Islam, which is jihad. I mean, every day Muslims are destroying tombs and churches of tombs of of Jewish people and churches of Christians in the Middle East. This is happening everywhere.
And killing Christians and others where they can get their hands on them, of course.
And it's going to Europe. Look at their killing Jews in Europe now, and many Jews are leaving Europe.
You've written a very important piece about anti-Semitism, in fact, that I want to come back to you about in the very near future. But we are hard out of time. And Noni, I'd also wanted to talk to you about the Southern Poverty Law Center, which has defamed you, among others, as a Islamophobe. There's so much more to talk about. I hope you'll give us a chance to do so in the near future. In the meantime, stay well. Come back to us soon. We'll talk to the rest of you, I hope, again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.